KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass
of a previous episode. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program.
Good morning and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Today's program is dedicated to the liver. The liver is the second largest organ in the body behind the skin, but it's the largest solid organ in the body, and it plays a crucial role in overall health and metabolism. Many things can impact our liver health. Chief among them are alcohol intake, obesity, diabetes, and medications that we take. Shockingly, about 30% of the population has liver dysfunction, which means that in Alaska, about 250,000 people suffer from a liver condition to include metabolic syndrome, fatty liver, cirrhosis, and hepatitis. I am very excited today to welcome Dr. Brian McMahon with us as a guest. He is a hepatologist, which is a specialist in liver disease. Do you have questions about your liver? If you have a question or a comment, please call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In the Anchorage area, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. I want to also remind our listeners that this program will be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Dr. McMahon, it's a pleasure to have you on Line One today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Clark, for asking me to join you. I'm looking forward to a good discussion, a lot of important questions and comments coming in.
I am very excited about this show today because as a bariatric surgeon, we are seeing huge amounts of liver dysfunction in our patients, and oftentimes I don't know how to deal with it. So I'm personally very excited to learn more about this. I understand you've been a guest prior. It's been a while, but back when Thad Woodard was a host, you did some shows with us.
Yes, that's true.
I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us a little bit about where you came from, your training, and a little bit of your history here in Alaska.
Well, thanks. Well, I grew up in Tacoma, Washington, went to Seattle University and then medical school at the University of Washington, and was doing my residency training in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California. And during the Vietnam War, and there was a draft for doctors, so I got drafted out of my training and joined the Public Health Service and went to Bethel, Alaska, where I spent a couple of years and noticed that there was a lot of hepatitis B in Bethel and a lot of liver cancer among children, and these children didn't have cirrhosis, and so that was quite alarming. It was before the hepatitis B vaccine was available, so when it became available, I had gone out and finished all my training and come back, and we did a vaccine phase 4 trial with the blessing of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Board in YK and Norton Sound, and stopped transmission in 14 villages where there was a high rates of transmission of hepatitis B. During that time, we found with epidemiologic studies that the virus survives on environmental surfaces probably indefinitely, but at least for 7 to 10 days, and can infect through open cuts and scratches. And you all know how we get mosquito bites in the summertime, and it can shed millions of particles of virus, live virus, on environmental surfaces. That's unlike HIV or hepatitis C, where those viruses don't last very long. And that's how I got interested in liver disease and moved on to other diseases. And now, fortunately, because of mass vaccination and a program that's been run by the tribal organizations, transmission of hepatitis B in rural Alaska is pretty much under good control. So we are now facing some of the other liver diseases that Dr. Clark was talking about, especially metabolic liver disease.
Yes, and you've been working here through the Native Health Consortium for quite some years.
Yes, I've been working at ANMC since 1978, And I do clinical now, just a couple of days a month, and most of the time I'm doing research on liver disease and public health on liver disease.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that as we go along too. There's some exciting research that you guys are involved in, but let's start with our listeners. You know, a little bit about what is hepatology, what a hepatologist is. You know, what the training is. How is it different than training for like an internist or a gastroenterologist?
So the formal training for hepatology would be 3 years of internal medicine, 3 years of gastroenterology, and then 1 or 2 years of hepatology. But most hepatologists don't go through that. They usually do internal medicine, and then they take fellowships in liver disease for 3 or 4 months of the year, or they mentor someplace where there's a liver program for a year or two and get the skills in hepatology. And most hepatologists don't do, for example, any kinds of colonoscopy or anything like that, but they will do upper endoscopies, especially to look for bleeding esophageal varices, which are present in patients with cirrhosis. They're blood vessels that swell up in the lower esophagus, right above the stomach, and they can, if the pressure is high, they can suddenly burst and be a life-threatening bleed. So that's pretty much what the hepatologist training does. And I was just going to mention that, as Dr. Clark said, that about 30% to 40% of people, including children, suffer from a liver condition. So that's what we'll talk more about today. Was there anything else you wanted me to mention about that?
No, I think that's great. I mean, it's training through internal medicine for the most part, and some gastroenterologies do a lot of liver work as well. I'm excited to learn that, you know, ANMC has 3 different liver specialists. Is that what you said?
Yeah, and we also have 2 mid-levels. And even at University of Washington, a lot of mid-level practitioners, nurse practitioners, PAs run most of the clinics down there. And the thing that's really important, and what we've been really trying to work on training physicians and mid-level practitioners, is that 90% of liver disease can be handled by a primary care practitioner. You don't need a specialist except for maybe 10% of the time.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's great to learn. I mean, we deal with it in our office all the time, so anything I can glean from today will be wonderful. I want to, we do have some calls coming in, which is excellent, but before we get to the call, I want to kind of establish a baseline. I want to explain to our listeners sort of what the normal functions of the liver are. Before we go into all the abnormalities, let's kind of define what normal is.
So the liver, as Aristotle would say, is the seat of the soul, and it is an incredible organ, which has, if kept healthy, has the ability to regenerate itself. And you can take a liver from a 70-year-old person and transplant it into a teenager, and it'll go for 20, 30 years or longer. You can also take half of a liver from a donor and transplant that into someone who needs a liver, and in 6 months that liver will grow back to the full size that it was. And in the donor, that half liver will grow to a full liver in 6 months. The liver does lots of different things. It metabolizes all of our nutrients, sends them around to the body where they're needed, proteins and vitamins. It also detoxifies, so when we ingest something that could be toxic to the body, the liver can detoxify it, so those are the main functions of the liver, providing nutrients, detoxification, and synthesizing proteins that our body really needs.
And it has an important role in sugars and glucose management, right? It's a storage organ as well for certain things.
It's a storage organ, right. It's for sugar, glucose, and also for fat. And so it does have a lot of those functions also.
Well, one of the toxins that that is common out there among everybody is some alcohol intake. So I think we have a question about that. Ian is calling from Juneau. Ian, welcome to Line 1.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, what can we answer for you today?
I have a question about how I work as an EMT for department, fire department unit called CARES, and we deal with a lot of chronic inebriates. And these people live in breath alcohol of mid threes to even mid fours, like consistently daily. And I was curious how that's possible when, you know, like a healthy, normal person is severely intoxicated in like the mid ones.
Sure.
Point one.
Yeah. No, thank you, Ian. Appreciate the question. I'll pose that here to Dr. McMahon. So Dr. McMahon, I mean, the liver is an amazing organ, so it must have a capacity to adapt to this, right? What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it can rev itself up and metabolize alcohol more rapidly. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing, because when it revs itself up like that, it can also metabolize other things like acetaminophen more rapidly and create toxic products from some of those things that it metabolizes. One thing I might say that's very interesting is that 50% of people that drink alcohol heavily never get cirrhosis, never get hepatitis. They just have fat in their liver. And about 50% of the persons who drink alcohol heavily end up with cirrhosis or hepatitis that leads to cirrhosis of the liver. The one good thing that we have right now is we have some very effective medications which can help people who have a drinking problem decrease the craving for alcohol. And those medications are very effective and can be given daily or be given by shots once a month. And people, it really helps people with craving for alcohol. The other interesting thing is some of the medications now that help for craving for foods, such as the GLP-1 medications like Wegovy, which you hear advertised on every other commercial on television for weight loss. There's medication also is appearing to work well for decreasing craving for alcohol and other compulsive behaviors such as compulsive gambling and things like that. So we'll see what the future holds with some of these other drugs. But we do have good tools now to help people who drink heavily. They have to want to stop, but it's not as hard as the old days of anabuse or going through withdrawal. It's much easier now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. So we encourage people who do drink a lot. And I just mentioned one thing is how much alcohol is too much. Well, for women, they should only drink no more than one alcoholic drink per day, or an average of 7 per week. For men, that would be 2 drinks per day, an average of about 14 per week. What's the dangerous amount? For men, it's 5 drinks a day. Or more, and for women it's 4 drinks a day or more. So in between that, there's definitely you're drinking too much, but you probably won't get into trouble. But if you drink more than 4 drinks a day as a woman and more than 5 or more drinks a day as a man, then you are high risk of developing damage to your liver and ending up with cirrhosis.
Okay. Well, that's great information. I want to give our listeners our call-in numbers again. Statewide, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. So just to piggyback on the alcohol a little bit, how does the liver metabolize alcohol? And why is there that range? I mean, is there some people where just a little bit of alcohol can cause problems, whereas some people can seem like our question to tolerate much more?
So the main enzyme that metabolizes alcohol is called alcohol dehydrogenase, and it goes through several steps and breaks alcohol down into water and carbon dioxide. And what's interesting, and I think anybody who's drank alcohol that's listening to this has experienced this, is that if you drink one or two drinks at a bar and you don't eat anything, all of a sudden it hits your head immediately. On the other hand, if you have a nice long casual meal at a bar and you drink two drinks, you don't really feel it anywhere as much. And the reason for that is that the linings of our stomach have alcohol dehydrogenase in them. So if you don't eat and you drink alcohol, it goes right through the stomach into the intestines, absorbed, and immediately goes into the bloodstream. If you do eat, it's delayed in the stomach as food is delayed, and it can, a lot of it can be metabolized by the alcohol dehydrogenase. What's interesting is that women have about 50% of alcohol dehydrogenase in their stomachs as men do. And in addition, women also have a lower body mass index, or a lower, way less. And so their levels of alcohol when they drink are going to be much higher, and that makes them more susceptible to developing liver damage from alcohol.
Oh, that's very interesting. And then what about Tylenol? Tylenol is another toxin that, you know, it's an incredibly important drug that we use all the time, but certainly there are limits to it, right?
Well, Tylenol is a very safe drug, but I think a lot of people feel that if it came on the market today, it probably would be a prescription drug because it can cause a lot of damage. It's the number one cause of liver disease from medication, which is called DILI, drug-induced liver intoxication. The reason for that is that if you take more, some people, we have metabolize alcohol slower than others, and if you take more than 3 to 5 grams of alcohol, that would be 6 500-milligram tablets to 10 per day, you can actually develop liver damage. If you drink and take Tylenol, that number is much lower. It's 1 to 2 grams per day can cause damage because alcohol interferes with the metabolism of acetaminophen. So be very careful. It's a great drug, but be very careful about the amounts that you take. And also for children, it's very important not to give children more than what it says on the label, depending on the age of acetaminophen.
Okay, that's great information. I didn't realize that it was so much reduced with alcohol intake. It makes sense,
yeah.
Of course.
Well, what happens is that the metabolism shifts into a different direction and produces a toxic metabolite rather than producing a metabolite that goes through and gets completely detoxified.
Yeah. Well, I want to take a short break here. You are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion with hepatologist Dr. Brian McMahon.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
Today's episode of Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a rebroadcast of a previous episode. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by hepatologist Dr. Brian McMahon. Do you have any liver-related questions? If you have a question or a comment, please call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, Dr. McMahon, looks like we got a bunch of calls coming in. So as we get those ready, let's just talk a little bit about the epidemiology of liver dysfunction. So I mentioned it a little bit in our open, but what's going on? I think the numbers are increasing, and I'm curious as to if this is more of an epidemic type thing, or are we just better at diagnosing and recognizing it? What are your thoughts on the liver dysfunction epidemiology?
Well, I think the epidemic is the most prominent thing, but also the fact that we have much better diagnostic tests and much better radiographic and other tests that we can do to measure scarring in the liver without having to do a biopsy of the liver. So we're much better at diagnosing, we have much better tools. But I think that since the late 80s and 90s, people have been gaining more weight and have the metabolic syndrome has been more prominent. More people have diabetes, more people have what we call dyslipidemia, meaning that they have high cholesterol, high triglycerides, and more people have hypertension, which is part of the metabolic syndrome also. And so that's leading to more fat in the liver, and we're going to talk, I think, about that a little bit later. The second thing is that what's alarming is that there are some places in the country which drink a lot, and Alaska, of all races, drinks twice as much alcohol as the average in the United States. And during COVID, alcohol intake dramatically increased in all places in the United States. So we have we drink too much, we eat too much, and also viral hepatitis is an important cause worldwide. Hepatitis B is present in about almost 300 million people, mainly in sub-Saharan Africa and South America, and especially in Asia and China, Vietnam, Taiwan. And we have a wonderful vaccine for the last 40 years, but it's not used enough to actually stop the transmission. And so the numbers are going up despite this inexpensive and highly effective vaccine.
Well, Dr. McMahon, regarding hepatitis, I think we have a call from Todd in Anchorage. Todd, welcome to Line 1.
Hello, Doc. I just have a question regarding hepatitis B. I contracted it before it was popular or known much about in the 1960s, and I'm wondering what the long-term sequelae are. I lived through it and lost about a third of my body weight.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Todd. Dr. McMahon, are there any long-term effects of a Hep B infection?
Well, hepatitis B can become chronic, especially if the younger you get it, the more likely it is, especially if you got it in childhood or at birth. And as I mentioned, it is a virus which is present on environmental surfaces. And so if you're in contact with somebody, you can get it without doing anything like can be contracted sexually, but also from mother to infant. But anybody can get it and get a hepatitis B. And it becomes chronic in about a third of children and about 10% of adults. And fortunately, we have some really good antiviral agents now that are very, very safe. They don't cure hepatitis B, but they can knock the virus way, way down. And the criteria for getting those is dependent on the level of your virus, your liver function tests, are they elevated, and also the amount of scarring in your liver, which can be detected by non-invasive techniques such as shear wave elastography or FibroScan, which is both are available here in Anchorage, and MRI elastography also. So we can diagnose scarring. We sometimes have to do a liver biopsy, but there are good antiviral drugs. And so if you have a physician that you can go see and they can refer you to a specialist here. We have gastroenterologists in town that can help, and infectious disease doctors, some of those are involved, and get a good analysis, and you can get a good medication that has minimal side effects and is very safe.
So if the body clears it, is there any long-term risk to having had that infection, or is there anything that Todd, per se, should keep an eye out for?
Right. So if you actually get it and then you become negative for the virus, so it's not present anymore, you still have the virus present in your liver. It's kind of like herpes or cytomegalic virus, for example. You never quite get rid of those viruses. And in the case of hepatitis B, you will never get into trouble if you've recovered after an acute infection unless you get chemotherapy or immunosuppressive therapy. So if you, for example, had rheumatoid arthritis and got medicine that would suppress rheumatoid arthritis, such as rituximab or one of the other medicines, then you could reactivate. The virus could be reactivated. Or if you got chemotherapy for cancer, colon cancer, breast cancer. So most oncologists know that they screen everybody for hepatitis B. And if they have a marker that they recovered, they will either monitor them carefully or put them on one of these safe antiviral medicines while they're taking their chemotherapy or their immunosuppressive therapy. And for maybe 6 months to a year after that, and then they can safely stop.
It looks like we also have a call related to Hep B antibodies. If we could go to line four, that would be great. Looks like Donna, are you in Eagle River here?
Yes, I am. I have a question. I was told through somebody who's a pediatrician that sometimes you can get the antibodies through a mother or a grandmother who might have had hepatitis B. And therefore, you can have the antibodies, natural antibodies in your body, but not the antigens. Is there any truth to that?
Absolutely, there is. But the only problem is that within 4 to 6 months, those antibodies are gone. And so you still need to vaccinate. All children need to be vaccinated against hepatitis B starting at birth. And then what? One good thing is that we've done the longest study in the world to see how long protection from hepatitis B vaccine lasts, and we're about to republish the 42-year follow-up study of people vaccinated who volunteered back in the 1980s, and the vaccine is about 90% protective at 42 years. So it's a very long-acting protective vaccine and extremely safe. It does not cause any serious side effects. So it is very, very safe, and it should be everybody. It's recommended now that every adult be screened for hepatitis B and then vaccinated if they're negative. So it's a universal vaccine for both children and adults.
Okay. I remember my kids, you know, it's like one of the first things that happens after they come out is right. Getting the Hep B vaccine. We have a call up from Fairbanks. Will from Fairbanks, welcome to line one.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question. I don't know if you could elaborate on it. Edema or body fluid retention is due to liver damage. That's the only question I have.
So let me clarify that, but Will. So are you asking about when someone has dysfunction, if they get edema, or is edema from liver dysfunction?
Well, can it cause it? I believe, yes. That's my question.
Okay. Thanks, Will. Dr. McMahon.
So most people that have edema, it's not caused by your liver being dysfunctional. It may be by you have varicose veins or something else that's resulting in the edema. But if you get cirrhosis of the liver and your liver fails and it can't get rid of the fluid, then you can develop edema. And usually you'll also have something called ascites, which is fluid in the abdomen, which can be picked up on physical examination, if there's a lot of it, but easily picked up on ultrasound examination. And those people that have fluid in their abdomen will oftentimes also have edema in their legs.
Okay, and I know, heart failure and things like
and
that.
And heart failure, right, exactly.
Lead to edema in the legs, but it's more of the ascites that you see, which is fluid in the abdomen. Okay. Katie is calling from Fairbanks with a question about transplants. Katie, welcome to line one.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Okay. So my brother died 2 years ago from complications of cirrhosis. He was 52 years old. And I felt like I interacted a lot with the medical community toward the end of his life, and I felt like there was a bit of a stigma against him because he, you know, he had cirrhosis in terms of, you know, getting a liver transplant and all that. And I was even a willing person to give him part of my liver, same blood type, all that. And I'm just wondering if you think in the future sort of that stigma will disappear once it's realized that, or it's accepted that this is more of a mental illness for alcoholics. Thank you.
Well, I agree. And my brother, who was in his 60s, died of liver failure. He was on the transplant list. He had metabolic liver disease. He was very overweight, had diabetes. Was not a person who drank a lot of alcohol, but the stigma is the same for anybody with cirrhosis. People can look at somebody with cirrhosis and say, oh, you did something bad to get this cirrhosis. And this is unfair, and this is something that's terrible. And I went through this, and even though I know all the transplant people at University of Washington, because we refer our patients there, whether you get the transplant or not is dependent on a score that's called the MELD score. And it's dependent on laboratory data, and then if you move up the MELD score, you'll be on the top of the list for transplant. And as our listener mentioned, you only need to match blood type. You don't have to match all these other types like you do for kidney. You just match the blood type. If it's the same, you can get a transplant from a donor, and it can be a living-related donor, or it can be a donor who's had an accident and died in a car crash or whatever. I'm surprised that if you were willing to provide a transplant part of your liver and also have the same blood type, that they didn't take you up on that.
I know that's very specialized surgery. I participated in some of those at University of San Francisco, California, and that's a very, very specialized living donor thing, only done at certain centers.
Yeah.
So my piggybacking on Katie's question is, kind of what I learned in my training was that, previously the most common reason for liver transplant was cirrhosis from alcohol. So cirrhosis, we can have you define that as well. But and it seems like in America that has shifted. And what I'm told, or what we learned, was that the most common reason is now fatty liver.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that true? And what are your comments on that?
That's absolutely the case. And some parts of the world, like in China and Taiwan, it's hepatitis B that's the number one reason for liver transplant. And it used to be in the United States until a few years ago, it was hepatitis C, which was the number one reason. And what's happened is that the metabolic syndrome is the number one reason. As far as alcohol goes, if people stop drinking, even with cirrhosis, they really do well. It's amazing, as long as their liver is not so scarred that it's failing. And also, a lot of people who drink alcohol heavily, they die of cirrhosis before they get liver cancer. So they don't get transplanted. And they're very strict rules. You have to be sober for 4 months. There are very sophisticated blood tests, which we can do, which will tell us if somebody actually drank as long as 2 weeks before. And if it's positive, you get bumped off the transplant list. And that's very tragic. And we've seen that happen with several of our patients. So 4 months of sobriety in order to get a transplant, even from a living-related donor, you have to follow those rules.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's important because the donor is put at high risk as well from this surgery. It's not just a little chip shot operation. It's a pretty big operation.
No, and you've seen that operation. I have too. And basically, the complication rate in a donor is about 10%. The chances of dying is probably only 1 in 500. But what happens sometimes is that when they take the liver out and they try sewing everything back up again, some of the sutures break down and they can leak bile or they can have bleeds and have to go back in and fix it. So basically, it's not it's a situation where you have to be very willing to give your liver and realize what the risks are.
Yeah. So with our remaining time here, I really do want to give you the opportunity to explain fatty liver, hepatitis liver, the metabolic syndrome.
Right.
And so I'll remind our listeners here, our call-in numbers statewide are 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Now, metabolic syndrome in the last few years has become, doctors have been more educated on what it is and how to diagnose this. There's now criteria that we use. But I always learned for our patients the way I describe it, and then you can tell me if I'm doing this wrong, please. There's kind of a spectrum of liver dysfunction, and we have normal liver, and there's fatty liver, and then there's hepatitis of the liver, followed by scarring of the liver. And a lot of what we do, trying to do our surgeries, is figure out where on the spectrum you are. Let's talk about what we used to call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and then non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. You have a new name for it.
Yeah, metabolic associated steatotic liver disease. That takes the stigma out of it. You don't have fat in there and you don't have alcohol.
Yeah.
And that's why they came up with this name. But there is the spectrum. So, there's a lot of genetics which you're really beginning to just understand. So hepatitis means inflammation of the liver. It can be caused by a virus. It can be caused by fat. It can be caused by medication, reactions to medications, and other. It can be an autoimmune. If the immune system can cause an autoimmune hepatitis, it's inflammation, and that if it doesn't go away, can lead to scarring of the liver. So as far as the metabolic syndrome goes. About 80% of people who have fat in their liver, and the way that it can be diagnosed, ultrasound is okay, but not great, but you can diagnose it by techniques for elastography. FibroScan is what the form that we use. It'll measure fat and scarring both. Takes about 20 minutes. We do it on literally everybody except those people who have pacemakers. We can do it all the way down to age 2. Below that, the kids won't hold still long enough to get it. We can do it in pregnant women now. It's okay to do. And you can measure both scarring and fat with the FibroScan machine. Another technique is shear wave elastography, which doesn't measure fat, but just measures the scarring. That's used by a lot of the radiologists here in town. And the other technique is MRI elastography, which is probably the best, but it's expensive and it takes a lot longer. It can measure, with the software, it can measure fat, and it also can measure, it always measures scarring. So we can do that, and sometimes we have to do a liver biopsy if we're not sure to see. But if you have fat in the liver, you have metabolic syndrome, or it's alcohol use that's causing that. And then the spectrum, 20% of people that have metabolic syndrome with fat in the liver get hepatitis, and it's probably genetic, and there are genetic markers that are now developed and they're being studied. We're actually going to do a study on them. And these markers will probably be used in the future to tell who's going to get it and who isn't going to get the hepatitis part of it, which can slowly lead to inflammation and scarring of the liver. And over about a 20 to 40 year period, about 50% of people that have the hepatitis form of this will end up with cirrhosis. So to put this in perspective, 750,000 Alaskan population, 250,000 with fat in their liver, and up to about 50,000 people could get cirrhosis of the liver if this goes on for a long period of time.
Well, it's just a shocking number.
It's a shocking and scary number to me.
I want to, we'll let that settle with our listeners here for a minute while we take our second mid-break, and I welcome your questions and calls. You are listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide, toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After the short break, we'll continue our discussion with hepatologist Dr. Brian McMahon.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't wait 24 hours to report a missing person. As soon as you suspect someone is missing, call your local law enforcement or 911 to make a report. Be ready to provide as much descriptive information as possible to help locate your friend, family member, or loved one. Your reporting can make all the difference, and maybe even save a life. Learn more about Alaska's Village Public Safety Officers at vpso.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Village Public Safety Officer Program.
Today's episode of Line 1, Your Health Connection, is a rebroadcast of a previous episode. We will not be taking phone calls or emails during today's program.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by hepatologist Dr. Brian McMahon. Do you have liver-related questions? If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, Dr. McMahon, we have about 20 minutes left here in the show. We have some calls coming in, and while those get queued up, let's talk a little bit about or continue our discussion on the metabolic syndrome. We screen our patients for it because I deal with obesity, and most of our patients have a form of fatty liver. Some of them have hepatitis or cirrhosis, but the testing, the criteria is pretty broad and easy. Do you have comments on sort of on what, how to diagnose metabolic syndrome? I mean, from a initial standpoint or lab standpoint?
Yeah, I think that the things that you look for is one or more of the features of what's called the metabolic syndrome. So that's overweight, especially if you have a body mass index of greater than 30. That's one of the metabolic syndromes. High cholesterol or high triglycerides, have diabetes or pre-diabetes, and hypertension. But a lot of people can get hypertension without the metabolic syndrome, so it's part of it, but also you need one other thing besides hypertension in order to say. Once you have criteria for the metabolic syndrome, then it's important that you be evaluated to see if there's any inflammation in your liver and any scarring going on in your liver. And again, you can have a fiber scan or a shear wave elastography test done to find out if that's the case, and then be followed for it. And then one of the other things is that if you do have any scarring or early inflammation, you can go on one of these medications that you see advertised on TV, the GLP-1 agonists, such as Wegovy, for example. I'm not supposed to mention brand names, but one of those medicines, and they really do work. Not only do you lose weight, but also they've been now shown, and one of them is approved for the use in MASH now. So which is the scarring and inflammation part of the metabolic syndrome in the liver, or it's about to get approved, I should say. And so and they're all probably going to work for that. So you can go on these medications and try we can follow you with fiber scans or shear wave elastography to see if your scarring is getting better, I'll talk about bariatric surgery, because that's probably the best way to get rid of MASH. And I'll let Dr. Clark talk about that. But I think we've got tools now, and we're learning more and more about it. So I think we really need to address this as a society, and we need to stop this epidemic and control it. And again, By the way, exercise and diet work just as well, but it's difficult to get people motivated to do that. Yeah. But usually if we use both medication and we work on diet and exercise at the same time, or we have bariatric surgery and work on diet and exercise afterwards, I think those are some of the best tools that we have.
Yeah, I agree with you, and thank you for the plug there. I didn't want to sound self-serving, but certainly surgery is by far the most effective weight loss option that we have out
Absolutely.
There. And we often in our program combine surgery with GLP-1s and other medications, as well as very intense diet, exercise, and mental health therapy. So you kind of have to hit it from all of the angles. We have some questions I do want to get to here. I'll just make a plug real quick. So the metabolic syndrome, we look at waist circumference, which is kind of a proxy for weight or central obesity, high blood pressure, your fasting glucose levels, as well as triglycerides, and then the HDL, which is the good cholesterol levels. If they're too low, that's a bad predictor yeah. too. So let's go with Heather is calling from Anchorage. Heather, welcome to line one.
Thank you. I think your most recent comments may have answered my questions, and I apologize for tuning in late.
No problem.
I may have to listen to the whole program over again tonight. My niece has autoimmune cirrhosis of the liver. It is definitely not related. I don't think she's ever had a drink in her life. She has been overweight. Her mother, my sister, had diabetes and lupus and died quite young at the age of 66. And my own health regimen is lots of, good diet and exercise because I don't want to develop diabetes. So the question that I have is this, is diabetes or this potential of autoimmune cirrhosis, is there a genetic factor? Is that something that I personally should worry about?
Okay, thank you, Heather.
Autoimmune hepatitis is a I don't say rare, but it's an uncommon disease. But in our large cohort of liver diseases, we have over 200 patients statewide that we follow with autoimmune hepatitis. It's a disease which can come on suddenly or slowly. It's easily treated by using corticosteroids like prednisone, cortisone-like drugs, and other anti-autoimmune drugs, such as azathioprine, is the most common drugs that we use. And we were able to get 90% of people under control, and they can live a full life. It's associated with other autoimmune diseases such as lupus, thyroid autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis. About half the patients have another autoimmune disease. And it is definitely genetic. We don't know what the genetic genes are that cause it, but definitely that's the case. And it's not anyone's, they haven't done anything wrong. It's just that they have been have developed this disease probably for genetic reasons. And then some, we think that some things can tip it off, but probably not diabetes. But if you have diabetes and autoimmune together, that's harder to control it, and you've got two things that are going against your liver instead of one. So it is important. And alcohol, we recommend that people with autoimmune liver disease don't drink alcohol. Same with the metabolic syndrome. They shouldn't, if they have MASH, they shouldn't drink alcohol.
Yeah, okay. William calling from Sitka. Welcome to line one. William, are you there?
I've got a concern about my liver, and that when I first went blind about 30 years ago, I got hit by a car in the crosswalk and literally got tossed over the car. And years later, several years back, I had gallbladder surgery. And that got complicated because everything was a mess inside. But what they did out of that, they explored around and looked at everything, had to rearrange things, put things back where they belong. But out of that, I learned that my liver had gotten torn badly and had scar tissue. Should I be concerned about that scar tissue?
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, William.
Not if your liver function tests are normal. If you get your liver function tests done and the liver enzymes are normal. Your platelet count when you get a blood count is normal. And then another test that's really important is called the INR, which is a clotting test. If that's normal and your albumin, which is a protein in your system, is normal, you're in good shape. But definitely you can have scar tissue that is around the liver. It can cause discomfort, but it's not affecting your liver inside of your liver itself. So go get those liver function tests done, and if they're all normal, the ones that I mentioned, you should be okay. But certainly that doesn't help your scarring any, but it certainly makes it that you can feel good about the fact your liver is functioning normally.
Sure. And I'll add there, William, too, as someone that's taken out many gallbladders, the gallbladder is attached to the liver very, very closely, and we have to peel the gallbladder off the liver. And so oftentimes there's damage to the liver, or we have to burn it to stop any bleeding on almost all of these surgeries. And there's no lasting effects of that, because the liver, at least a healthy liver, will heal that in no time. So, and we have a call from Michael in Anchorage about lab work. Michael, welcome to Line 1.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just had my annual physical, and the doctor did the normal routine blood test. And I'm wondering if any of those numbers would be specific to possible liver disease.
Right. Usually you get a liver function test, which also includes kidney and albumin, which is the main circulating protein, and also your electrolytes, sodium, potassium, et cetera. And that's usually what is done. And glucose is also a part of that panel. The specific liver function tests are called ALT and AST and alkaline phosphatase. So if those are in the normal range, you're in good shape. If they're elevated, then you want your provider to look into why they might be elevated and do more testing.
Yeah, AST and ALT are commonly checked. And you can have a liver dysfunction but have normal labs. Sometimes the labs don't change until later in the course, though, right?
Right. And the other thing about the metabolic syndrome, and I can talk about my brother. He's not with us anymore. His liver enzymes would go up and down. He'd go on a diet, and they'd go back down again. And then he'd go off the diet, and they'd go back up again. So as Dr. Clark was saying, you could be in one of these cycles where you've gone on a diet, and the fat's moved out of your liver, and the liver enzymes have gone down, and then they can go back up again. So you could have damage without having elevated liver enzymes.
Yeah, so it's just a general screening test. So,
right.
Yeah. And Martin from Fairbanks, welcome to Line 1.
Hello. I had a gallbladder question. The only time I'm a retired RN for many years, and only time I've had to call an ambulance for myself was a couple years ago. I had a sudden onset, what turned out to be a surgical emergency, which required a procedure called an ERCP. And believe it or not, it was 20 below outside. I live alone, and they ended up air ambulance flights mm-hmm. all the way to Salt Lake City because they could not find a gastroenterologist trained in that particular procedure. Not even in Seattle that was available. So anyway, but everything turned out okay, and the care was great. But would you talk about, you know, the training required for that procedure? And then, of course, I lost, you know, they came back in later and took my gallbladder out. What are the ramifications of having, you know, I suspect, if you know, I couldn't say I know for sure, that there are a lot more gallbladder surgeries than there are actual liver surgeries.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so as common as they are, would you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Martin.
On the air.
Thank you, and I think that's going to be a topic for an upcoming show, the gallbladder itself, because it's its own topic, its own organ. It's attached to liver, but it's a little bit separate. But then ERCP is generally done by a gastroenterologist. It's done by a camera going down the mouth into the stomach, and then the small intestines, where they can go up with small probes and things and get stones that have escaped the gallbladder and gotten into the bile ducts. And so, but not all gastroenterologists do that. And so it kind of depends on who's on call at any particular time. So we'll talk more about that on a later show, but thank you for the call, Martin. Dr. McMahon, we only have a few minutes left. I know you wanted to have a comment on Hep C. I'm going to give you the opportunity to do that.
So hepatitis C is another virus, and it's very common. About anywhere from 2 to 3% of the population has hepatitis C. Prior to the discovery of the virus back about 1990, a lot of people got it from blood transfusions because we had no tests for it, or they got it from tattooing or ear piercing or body piercing. It's hard to transmit without some sort of an injection. Now it's mainly seen in injecting drug users. But because of the fact that a lot of people got hepatitis C before there was a test, it's recommended by the CDC that everybody get screened one time, every adult one time, for hepatitis C. And if you're an injecting drug user, you get screened on a regular basis. But we have these wonderful miracle drugs, literally. I've never seen anything like it in my life. You take pills for 8 to 12 weeks, and you get 97% cure without any serious side effects. It's incredible. And 50% of people with hepatitis C will go on to get cirrhosis before they die or liver cancer. So every adult needs to be screened one time for hepatitis C, because they might have gotten it earlier in life.
Okay.
And then they can get cured and be great.
Yeah, these drugs, I think I heard a little about them a few years ago, but they came out, they were quite expensive to begin with, right? Or are they still expensive?
They were $100,000. Now they're down to $20,000. They should be $1,000 because they make them in countries like Vietnam and Thailand for about $200. So it's really need to be either generic, which probably will be another four or five years, or they need to really drop the price down so it's more reasonable.
Yeah. Well, Dr. McMahon, we have about 1 minute left before we have to close up shop here. Can I ask you to provide our listeners with any closing remarks, any thoughts that you have for them?
Well, one of the things that we always tell people is to love your liver. And I will tell you one good news is that it turns out that coffee is really good for your liver, and it's not the caffeine. It is in the bean. We don't know what it is, but there's been many, many studies which have shown this. The best one came out of England. They followed a million people with cirrhosis for 10 years, and they found that people who drank any kind of coffee had a 50% decrease in mortality from liver failure or liver cancer. So if you have a liver problem, or if you like coffee, caf or decaf, we recommend anywhere from 1 to 3 cups a day of coffee.
Well, I can tell you I'm never going to get liver cirrhosis, but I hope it doesn't have hurt to have more than that.
No, you can have as much as you want.
All right. Well, special guest. Special thanks today for our guest for being here, hepatologist Dr. Brian McMahon. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. This program will also be available on demand through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Amazon Music. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast, The Sandpoint City Council meets the second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers. Contact the City of Sandpoint by calling 907-383-2696, emailing sptcity@arctic.net, or visiting their website at sandpointak.com. KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint. K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove. KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay. KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass.